From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a drone strike apology, anger on the streets of Baltimore, Loretta Lynch confirmed, and a migrant crisis in the Mediterranean. Freddie Gray died on Sunday in police custody, and questions and protest filled the streets of Baltimore.
United we stand!
United we fall!
United we stand!
United we fall!
A deadly mistake. President Obama apologizes for a drone strike in Pakistan that took the lives of two Al-Qaeda hostages, one an American, one an Italian.
It is a cruel and bitter truth that in the fog of war generally, and our fight against terrorists specifically, mistakes, sometimes deadly mistakes, can occur.
And European leaders gathered to confront a migrant crisis in the Mediterranean. French President François Hollande said the real problem, the terrible cause, is in the instability of the countries the migrants are fleeing.
Even if we spend more, do more surveillance, have more presence in the sea, more cooperation and fight more against terrorists, the terrible cause will still be there. This country is no longer ruled, no longer governed.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Juana Summers of NPR News, Yoki Driesen of Foreign Policy, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your top story this week? The death of Freddie Gray, the drone strikes, Loretta Lynch? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Juana Summers, congressional reporter for NPR News. Juana Summers, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Also from Washington, Yoki Driesen, managing editor for news at Foreign Policy. Yoki, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. Pleasure to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Yoki, and Juana.
The president making an apology for strikes that took place in January. One in particular. Yes, Al-Qaeda members killed, also an American and an Italian. Here he was this week speaking Thursday, announcing those deaths.
As president and as commander-in-chief, I take full responsibility for all our counterterrorism operations, including the one that inadvertently took the lives of Warren and Giovanni. I profoundly regret what happened. On behalf of the United States government, I offer our deepest apologies to the families.
To the families of American Warren Weinstein and the Italian Giovanni Laporto. Yoki Driesen, what have we glimpsed here in what's finally come out months after the event? What are we learning about the American drone campaign?
I think we're learning that it continues even when it doesn't get as much attention as it used to in Afghanistan and Pakistan. There have been drone strikes much more recently in Yemen and Syria and Somalia. And kind of our focus as reporters, as a country, has shifted more to those and a bit away from Pakistan. And really, the drone war there continues. There were two things that I found really interesting yesterday. One was it was clear how ambivalent Obama is about drones, even though drones are his weapon of choice in his war against Al-Qaeda. So it's an easy shorthand to say, well, drones are what he relies on, so therefore he must really like drones. It's clear from previous comments, from these comments, that he has a real ambivalence about using them, about the efficacy, about the legal. And that was just very striking to me, especially since so much of his six-minute talk yesterday was very deeply personal, almost unusually so. He said, as a husband, as a father, he painted it in very human terms initially and then transitioned very quickly to very legalistic terms. One other just very quick point. After the deaths, the widow of Warren Weinstein, he has a family website that had some very heartbreaking photos of him. Yeah. But she posted a statement that thanked Maryland's two senators and a congressman and the FBI for their help, but then really, really hammered the rest of the government, which means the administration, for not doing more to bring him back and not keeping them more in the loop about what was happening. That was striking to me.
Yoki, I want to press you on this notion of President Obama as deeply ambivalent about drones. I mean, I think that the drone has the reputation as the Obama administration weapon of choice, presented as kind of surgical, hands-off, as an alternative to boots on the ground. It's very, very closely identified. It started, of course, under George W. Bush, but the numbers ramped up dramatically under President Obama.
And I think that's what's so fascinating about him. I mean, it's sort of the Obama as commander-in-chief at war with the Obama as constitutional law professor. In a lot of his comments, what he basically says is, yes, there are tough questions about drones. Yes, we should talk about them more. Yes, they should be debated. And he sort of says that again and again and again. Last year, he gave what was billed as a major speech on drones, Attorney General Eric Holder gave a major speech on drones. They were trying to make a legal argument for why they could be working, why they could be legal, why they could be part of guidelines set by the administration to make sure civilians weren't killed. But even the fact that they're giving those kind of speeches, the fact that they're speaking so often about how there are legitimate questions about the program, it gives you a bit of a clue into the fact that, yes, they use them, but they're not enthusiastic about using them.
Juana Summers, do you see ambivalence here in this Pentagon, in this administration? Yes, these speeches have been given, but in my recollection, they always come after some kind of public revelation of a disastrous misstep with drones, Juana.
Right. And obviously, I don't cover national security and foreign policy quite as closely, but at least from a public vantage point, there does seem to be a level of ambivalence here. Now, what goes on behind closed doors as the administration and those with access to classified information are discussing these instances, particularly when there are casualties like the ones the president addressed this week? It would be really interesting to kind of be a fly on the wall and hear how exactly they address that and what it's like when there are no microphones and no cameras around.
In Pakistan, there's been a green light for the CIA to do so-called signature strikes, where you may not know exactly who's down there, but it has the signature of an al-Qaeda location. Jamil Jaffer, deputy legal director at the ACLU, responded in a way to that this week, talking on NPR on Thursday. He said that he's troubled that the U.S. is launching deadly drone strikes with so little information about exactly who is down there.
I would say it raises troubling questions about the reliability of the intelligence the government is using to justify these kinds of strikes and the depth of that intelligence. You know, in each of these operations, the government literally didn't know who it was killing.
Jack Beatty, what do you see in the Obama administration's handling of drone war?
Well, we see, first of all, a popular policy here. Two-thirds of the public supports it. At the same time, it has provoked an immense backlash in the Muslim world. Anybody looking at the foreign press can see that. So whether the American public has caught on to it or not, it seems to be a dead loser in the battle for our hearts and minds abroad. Second, the administration, its criterion for killing, here's what it says, it continuing imminent threat to U.S. persons. That's what justifies the killing. We have to be candid here. The main U.S. person threatened, at least in the immediate term, is the President of the United States, because, of course, if there should be any terrorist attack here of substantial size, and if it could be traced back to, you know, some mountainous redoubt in Yemen or in Pakistan, the president, who hadn't done anything about it, would be blamed. So the president is, first of all, it seems to me, concerned with protecting himself against the damage to his reputation. And, you know, James Madison warned against this. He said, in no part of the Constitution is more wisdom to be found than in the clause which confides the question of war or peace to the legislature and not to the executive. The trust and temptation would be too great for any one man. The strongest passions and the most dangerous weaknesses of the human breast, ambition, avarice, vanity, the honorable, the venial, love of fame, are all in conspiracy against the desire and duty of peace. James Madison on the temptation of power for a president, and a president who can use force without any of the downsides of using force. You're not going to get a plane shot down out of the sky. Last week, Ray Mabus, the Secretary of the Navy, made a really historic announcement. He said that the F-35 Lightning, a new plane, strike plane being prepared for the Navy, it's likely to be the last manned strike fighter in Navy history. From then on, all drones.
Of course, Yoki, it wasn't just a dead American aid worker down there. There were also two Americans who had become part of al-Qaeda, Ahmed Farouk and Adam Gadan, also killed in drone strikes in January. Do you see an imminent threat? I mean, they were very prominent propagandists, one of them. Another involved, we're told, in a command in al-Qaeda. Imminent threat, Yoki?
It's hard to see an imminent threat, frankly, and I think Jack hit it on the head in most of the people who've been killed in drone strikes dating back several years. I mean, it's very hard to imagine how people who were killed, and again, Jack made the point, and I agree with it, they didn't know who exactly they were going to be killing even if the drone hadn't killed the American or the Italian. So if you don't know who they are, how do you know that they're making an imminent threat to the United States? The continued sort of diminishment of the criteria for a drone strike is extraordinary. It also comes at a time when the U.S. insists again and again and again there are no civilian casualties. This is a most precise weapon in history. And there's very convincing arguments made by human rights groups, by investigative journalists, that you've had hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians killed and thousands of civilians injured. So this is not a weapon that just can, in this one case, go awry. This is a weapon that kills innocents again and again and again. With Adam Gadan and with Ahmad Farouk, if you remember, just it's
Americans in Al Qaeda.
Americans in Al Qaeda. It's interesting how much the debate has shifted. When the U.S. first killed an American citizen without trial several years ago, it was another propagandist, Anwar al-Awlaki, later his son, there's a big storm about it. Now no one cares. These are two Americans, probably terrorists, perhaps deserving by national security standards of death. But the notion that they are killed without trial, no one cares. That's no longer even part of the discussion.
Juana Summers, do you feel on Capitol Hill or here on Capitol Hill an urge to get more oversight of the drone campaign, or are they happy to leave it to the Pentagon and the president?
There has certainly been quite a bit of debate over just how much oversight is appropriate and what the role Congress should play here. But one thing I do want to note that was really interesting to me is that while House Speaker John Boehner, Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi, asked about this in dueling press conferences yesterday as this news broke, this incident was not a big topic on Capitol Hill. And I found that really striking. Some of the people you would expect to hear the loudest from, say, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, who is wants to be president. You're not hearing from people like that. And I find that silence to be frankly fascinating.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Mediterranean migrants, Loretta Lynch confirmed, drone strike apology, anger now in Baltimore over police action. Juana Summers is with us, congressional reporter for NPR. Yoki Driesen is here from Foreign Policy, managing editor for News there. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to our listeners. Maureen, Melrose, Massachusetts. Maureen, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I've been concerned for years, Tom, about the number of people we have killed by the drones. They always say that, well, they're not quite sure who they are, but they are pretty sure that they're against us. But there is never any kind of hearing nor proof. And we killed 4,000 under Obama already. And along with the man suspected, also often his parents, elderly parents, his wife and children. They can't be quite be that exact just to kill the one man.
What about, Maureen, the argument, fog of war, war's not pretty, these things happen, that sort of argument?
That's not enough. We're killing more than we have to. We're killing people just suspected. I don't recall ever having that done in other wars before this. But how can they be really sure of the person they are killing? I know that there is a secret police over there and so forth, but we cannot be that certain. And without really being positive about it, aren't they going to want to get back at us by having killed 4,000 people over there with their drones?
Maureen, point taken. It seems that there is an accepted margin of error here. And, of course, as you point out, that yes, that means human lives. David in Stanton. Thank you, Maureen. David in Stanton, Virginia. David, you're on.
Hello, Tom. Thank you. My comment is on the drones. I have two sons-in-law who have served multiple tours in Afghanistan and Iraq. Mm-hmm. One is currently serving in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And the point is, this whole discussion of the drones is hypocrisy. Our whole misadventure in Iraq and Afghanistan has resulted in probably over 100,000 civilian deaths. Our alternative to getting to these al-Qaeda's is to send in a group of soldiers to do the same thing and risk casualties and additional civilian deaths to accomplish the same thing.
Your sons-in-law potentially and more on the ground, wherever it might be, David.
That's correct. And this is war. You know, we shouldn't have been in there in the first place, but we're in there now, and the American people expect President Obama to go after these terrorists. And the idea that we should go in and arrest these Americans who have turned against America and have taken up the cause of al-Qaeda at the risk of our soldiers is insane.
David, we've got it very clearly, and the ambivalence there. This is war. We shouldn't have been in there in the first place, but point taken again there, David, and one more on this front. Paul in Des Moines, Iowa. Paul, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I gotta say, as a veteran, and as a veteran of OIF, that I find what my president said this week appalling. I use the words fog of war. This isn't fog of war. This is intentional ignorance. They don't want to know who they're targeting. And it's appalling to me that so many people in this nation seem okay with the fact that we're killing possibly hundreds, possibly thousands of innocents, and we have no idea how many are dying.
Paul, I don't doubt that we don't know exactly how many are dying. In fact, the White House is careful to keep a lot of that secret. They do not make it. On the other hand, I have to challenge your intentional ignorance charge a little bit here. I mean, there are a lot of intelligence assets being put in to try and track down al-Qaeda leaders, are there not?
But, Tom, when you're saying the words like, well, we're not exactly sure who's there, that's not intelligence.
No, that's true.
That's guesswork. I'm a former intelligence officer, and I'm telling you right now, if someone said, we don't know exactly who's there, my commanding officer would not go forth with a mission if he could not tell who is in a building.
Paul, I appreciate your call and from that experience as well. Yoki, last thought on this. Do you see a change in policy coming here, or likely the drones fly on?
I think the drones fly on. I think they fly on in more and more places. Maybe not Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Syria, and then God knows where else, and probably very soon.
Juana Summers, let us turn to Congress, if we may, and Loretta Lynch. We're reading here that no one has taken longer to be confirmed as Attorney General beyond Edwin Meese, President Reagan's nominee, and Mitchell Palmer in the Woodrow Wilson years. Would you remind us of the basic holdup here? Why did it take so long, Juana?
It's kind of laughable almost, because the holdup had very little to do with Loretta Lynch's qualifications or, frankly, her at all. It had to do with two things, one of them being immigration and the second being an unrelated provision on human trafficking bill. Most Republican senators who opposed Lynch's nomination didn't have much to say about her qualifications. Many, in fact, agree that she has had a storied and impressive career. But what they didn't like is the fact that she made a legal endorsement of President Obama's executive actions on immigration, as well as the fact that they question whether or not she could act independently enough as the head of the Justice Department from the Obama administration. Republicans, of course, have not had the best relationship, to say the very least, with her predecessor, Attorney General Eric Holder. The second thing that paused a holdup, just very briefly, was a human trafficking bill that was delayed as there was a flap over an anti-abortion provision. But that was all. That compromise was met on Tuesday. That bill was dispensed with, which paved the way for a vote on Lynch's nomination nearly 6 months after the president nominated her back in November.
I mean, closer to Lynch, the abortion piece sat out there in that legislation, yes. But you say it didn't have to do with her, but she did support the president on his executive actions on immigration. Was that the greater offense to the Republicans opposing her, or was it a desire to punish the Attorney General's office because they have been so embittered toward Eric Holder?
Tom, I think the answer there is both and. Republicans were in a real bind here. They don't like Eric Holder. They've described him as lawless. The House has gone so far to hold him in contempt in June of 2012. And yet they get a replacement in Loretta Lynch, who, for all intents and purposes, is qualified, but she has outright said that she supports immigration executive actions by a Democratic president that they vehemently oppose. So it was a really tough spot for them. And then you see this long-standing delay that many people tried to assert was because of race, that Republicans said was because of at first immigration and later this human trafficking bill. It's not an enviable position that they were in to kind of force their discontent. They were kind of in a corner, and this is what resulted.
Jack Beatty, this is the hurly-burly of deep political division, or this is offensive to the new Attorney General to be?
I think that she was caught up in something beyond her. I mean, this isn't to do with her qualifications, mm-hmm. as Juana says, or her background, which are exemplary in every way, but rather with a pattern of hostage taking. You know, the Senator McConnell has again and again said, we're going to take this bill hostage to get that, get something we mm-hmm. want out of the administration. It was therefore passing strange, or perhaps you could say it was a grace note, that Senator McConnell brought himself to vote for the new Attorney General.
Let's turn to Baltimore. And yet again, you know, starting in Ferguson, and it's just marched on and on, incident after incident. Now where people seem to almost automatically, I don't mean to say without reason, hit the streets after police violence. This time, you've got Freddie Gray, who was chased, taken into police custody, ends up dead. Injured, broken. Here we've got a statement from Gene Ryan, the president of Baltimore's Fraternal Order of Police, talking about those protests, likening them to a lynch mob. Here he is in a news conference on Thursday.
They've already tried and convicted the officers, and that's just unfair. They still get their day in court. They did not give up their constitutional rights when they became a law enforcement officer. That's what I was getting at to that. Some of the protesters and some of the stuff I've been watching on the news, they want them in, put in prison. Well, they have been charged, number one. Number two, they still get their day in court.
People are fed up, and they are ready to show it and show it in the streets. Here's a protester this week in Baltimore talking with CNN's Miguel Marquez.
This police force in Western District has a history of police brutality. The entire district needs to be shut down, and every officer in that district, the next words they should hear is, you have a right to remain silent.
The officers should be hearing that. At a news conference on Tuesday, the city's African-American mayor, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, demanded answers over the death of Freddie Gray.
I'm frustrated. I'm angry that we are here again, that we have had to tell another mother that their child is dead. I'm frustrated that not only that we're here, but we don't have all of the answers. I want to know why the officers pursued Mr. Gray. I want to know if the proper procedures were followed.
Juana Summers, I am confused by this case. I must admit, the outcome is clear. You've got a dead man here, and there weren't even charges. I mean, it appears as though he was running away from the police. They chased him. That hardly seems like anything beginning to approximate justification for what happened here. But I don't really understand what happened here. We've heard Kevin Moore, who ran out and filmed a lot of this, a lot of the film that we've seen on television, said that, and who knew Freddie Gray, said that Gray was handcuffed. He was planted face down on the ground with a Baltimore bicycle police officer's knee on his neck, another bending his legs backwards so his heels were on his back. They said they had him folded like a crab or a piece of origami. He was all bent up. But do we know where this injury came from? One, is it clear that it came behind closed doors in the police van?
Tom, I think you're confused and I'm confused. And frankly, the people that are in the streets of Baltimore marching right now are really confused. It's not clear exactly where this injury originates from. It's been reported that there were not cameras inside the police van that Freddie Gray was transported in when this injury potentially occurred. A lawyer has said that he was perhaps not seatbelted in. But it's important to note two things about the situation. It comes at a time when
that sounds a little ridiculous, I have to say. There were how many people in that van and he's the one who ends up dead. But anyway, point taken.
I think that what's important to note also is that this comes at a time where there is very little trust between law enforcement and minority communities across this country after what we saw in Ferguson, Missouri, after what we saw in Staten Island with Eric Garner. And this is a police department that also has a long history of issues. The Baltimore Sun had a fascinating report last year, and they note that the city has paid out roughly $5.7 million since 2011 over lawsuits claiming that police officers brazenly beat up alleged suspects. And when I've talked to people on the streets of Baltimore, they have concerns about this. They're saying, yes, Freddie Gray died and that shouldn't have happened. But this is a police department that has had issues like this for a long time. And no one, including the mayor, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, who we just heard a couple minutes ago, is paying attention or doing anything.
I mean, we heard the voice of that protester in the street saying there's a long history of police brutality here. We'll look at it. Calvin in Sumter, South Carolina. Calvin, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Here's what we have here. I'm a protester here for the North Charleston that just happened, a couple weeks ago. And the thing is, this is a systematic thing that's happening all across the country. And they can go, and then they're trying to break it down state by state and individual by individual.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the problem. Until they do something, they're going to have something on their hand and they're not going to be able to control because the people have gotten fed up. They're not putting up with it no more. And they're unifying because of this, because the system is allowing them to get away. Here in South Carolina, you had 209 cases of shootings, not one prosecution.
Not this is one police shootings, yeah. And a readiness there
Calvin, I mean, we can all kind of see what you're talking about. Juana Summers, I don't expect you to be an expert on the, you're African-American. That doesn't make you an expert on this. But do you feel, maybe it's what we all see. Look in Baltimore. This happens, and boom, people are in the streets. And Calvin's right. The message is immediately, we're not going to take this in the same way anymore.
That certainly is the message. And I, speaking as someone who has covered these issues, someone who was a reporter in St. Louis, someone who spends a lot of time in Baltimore, I think that there is a feeling that it's just every day you open the newspaper, there's something new. There is a North Charleston, there is a Ferguson, there is a Staten Island, there is now a Baltimore. I can imagine that if you're a person who's just walking down the street trying to live their life, go to work, take their kids to school, that has to get really old to think that just by doing the basic things of living your life, you might lose it.
Claire in Madison, Wisconsin. Claire, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Tom. I was just stunned when I heard that officer representative for the union say that these officers in Baltimore are right now being convicted without a trial, when that is the whole point of the protesters in these cases across the country, that these victims at police people's hands have been killed without having a trial.
Yeah, okay, maybe so on the officers, but what about Freddie Gray and all the others we've seen in succession? Claire, I take your point. Thank you for calling. Jack, here's a comment from a listener online, though, says, noting that Baltimore has lots of African-Americans in the police force, as an African-American mayor, how can Baltimore find itself beset with such unrest? Maryland has been a bastion of Democratic Party politics since forever. How can Democratic strongholds be so insensitive to constituent needs? Jack?
Well, yes. Our caller from Carolina who raised the issue of a systemic pattern of this is just unquestionably right. I mean, and one of the things that's made it systemic is we haven't been able to tell, as FBI Director Comey pointed out, where there are no statistics kept, accurate statistics on police killings of civilians, of suspects, of anybody. And so we haven't even been counting it. And it's gone down beneath the radar. And what we see, I think, in all of these things is just aspects of brutalization. You know, the hashtag Black Lives Matter, that's so important because it's that we see violated, that they don't matter.
It's so elemental.
Policemen, and this is cross races, I'm afraid, just are so attuned to push these young men around and to the limit. And you know, in Baltimore, Juana brought up the suits about the police brutality, and there's an aspect to these that the Baltimore Sun reported this week, and that is that when they when they settle lawsuits out of court with people on this, the person who gets the money must promise to be silent about the incident that sparked the suit in the beginning. And thus there was a elderly woman who was beaten up, and she told about being beaten up online, and her and the city went after her and cut her the indemnity they paid her in half. So Mayor Blake says, "Oh, we're doing everything we can to prevent this, but they're covering up." Essentially having a vow of romanta over the people who are victims of this.
It's turning into a big mural the country is looking at here. That deputy who shot instead of tasing the African-American who was running away in Oklahoma, not in prison, in fact, given permission to go off on a Bahamas vacation by the judge there this week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, ice cream and Listeria Bluebell recalled its entire product line over fear of Listeria contamination. Bluebell CEO Paul Cruzy apologized to Bluebell customers in an internet video.
Ice cream is a joy and a pleasure to eat. It certainly is for me, and I do it every day. And it should never be a cause for concern.
Dr. Mehmet Oz responded to a letter from 10 doctors sent last week to Columbia University, where Oz serves as vice chair of the surgery department. The letter accused Oz of an egregious lack of integrity and for promoting quack treatments on his show. Oz said they didn't understand.
The show's purpose is not to talk about medicine. The show's purpose is to talk about the good life, what you need to do to live your best.
And this week marks 20 years since the Oklahoma City bombing and 100 years since the massacre of Armenians by Ottoman Turks. Children sang at a ceremony in Armenia's capital, Yerevan, today to mark the centenary of the genocide. And it is remembered. The week in the news, we're looking at Mediterranean migrants, Loretta Lynch, drone strike apology, Baltimore, and more. You can join us. Juana Summers is with us, congressional reporter for NPR. Yoki Driesen is here, managing editor at Foreign Policy. And I want to turn to that terrible death toll in the Mediterranean. Last Sunday, down goes a ship, 800 or 900 dead there, and the ships just keep coming, and they keep going down, and people keep dying. European leaders gathering this week to try and figure out some response, whether to take in more, take them off the water more quickly, or to try and suppress at origin. That seemed like a good part of the consensus. Here was European Council President Donald Tusk saying Europe needs to work closely with the countries from which migrants are fleeing to discourage them from traveling to Europe in the first place.
I think the best way to protect people from drowning is by ensuring that they do not get on the boat in the first place.
Do not get on the boat in the first place. But there's economic and pressure. There's terrible insecurity. Countries coming apart. Failed states. Yoki Driesen, what is Europe facing here?
I think Europe is facing the reality that there is no good way to stop this. When you have people who are not stupid, migrants who are trying to come across the water know that the risks are there. They know they may die from drowning. They know they may capsize. The reason they're willing to go is because they think that risk is better than staying where they are. So this notion that, well, just persuade them to stay, make it harder for them to leave, it's fanciful. I think what you're seeing with Europe is the conflict and collision of two impulses that the continent has, one they like to speak of and one they don't. On the one hand, they hold themselves up as a beacon for liberal values, for humanitarian values. And on the other, there is a rising tide of xenophobia, of anti-immigrant sentiment, of right-wing anti-Muslim sentiment. And when you have those two collide, as you do here, it gets tricky because you have Europe that says we are the beacon, we're a place people can come to and be treated humanely. And then you have a big part of Europe whisper, but we don't want more people and we don't want these people. And so you're seeing that collision when you have statements that are for policies that are frankly hard to imagine them ever being put in place or ever working.
They seem to be opting in no small part for suppression here to try and take these boats down before they can even fill with potential migrants.
That's right. We're also looking for legal changes where simply reaching the shores of the EU isn't enough for you to get refugee status or humanitarian aid. They are trying to do something that the U.S. has also done, which is to make advertisements in some of these countries that are sort of hard-hitting and try to make these points that even if you get here, it's not the good life. But for people who are willing to take the risk of their life, their spouse's wife, their children's life, to cross the water, they know that risk and they still think it's better than staying where they are. So unless you have a really concerted military effort to stop these ships at sea, which the EU doesn't have the money for or the willpower for, I just don't see how this changes.
Tavish in Boston is calling. Hi, Tavish. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I have a comment and a question regarding the European migrant crisis. I mean, it's pretty shocking to see the leaders of all of these major countries sort of hold their hands above their heads, thinking that this was sort of something that just came out of the blue. I mean, the intervention in Libya, everybody expected that there was going to be major repercussions from it. And while they conducted their campaign, they did nothing to help civil society on the ground. So essentially that country, which is already a mix of different ethnicities and different groups that Gaddafi would play off of in order to retain his power, disintegrated into nothing. And now you're finding weapons going as far as Syria. The sort of crisis in Mali was directly linked to this. And so my question for the panel is this going to have them rethink interventions, especially in places that are so near to Europe, and sort of interventions in general and long-term blowback? Thank you.
I appreciate your call, Tavis. Jack Beatty, this is on Europe's doorstep, but you have enormous mixed messages here. Intervention in Libya and then chaos, a kind of failed state there now, and it becomes the great spigot or portal. No intervention, Jack, in Syria, and you could say that its disintegration is even much worse and more ominous. What's the lesson?
Yes, and if we hadn't intervened in Libya, remember Colonel Gaddafi's one of his sons was driving a squadron of tanks was on the way to Benghazi. We were hearing about a massacre potentially of 35,000 people. The president didn't want to get involved, but the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, his national security advisor, and others said, you've got to. At the time, he referred to Libya as, quote, a turd sandwich. And we did intervene, and Benghazi was spared, but not Libya from the chaos. That's one model. But and then the other model, not intervening, as you say, things are just as bad there. And yet a third model is Yoki's magazine brings out is Eritrea. That, if you look at the numbers, Syrians lead in the numbers of these refugees. And then second, Eritreans. Well, why Eritrea?
Yeah.
Well, according to the article, they are doing well by the Millennium Development Goals set by the UN, that is to do with poverty alleviation, education, health care, and so on. Looks pretty good. And yet they're the number two in sending out migrants on these often fatal journeys, and part of the reason is that it's a sort of police state with a long-term draft, and people run away from it.
And Europe, looking at all this, Tsagai is calling from Buffalo, New York. Tsagai, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm from Eritrea originally, and then I came to U.S. in 2005, and then I had to leave Eritrea in 2002. And then I had to travel from Eritrea to Ethiopia about 8 hours in the middle of the night. And then it was a horrible road.
Why, Tsagai? Why are people leaving Eritrea? The standard of living is said to be not the worst. You don't have war there?
Oh, no, Tom. Trust me. The life is so... Eritrea is one of the poorest countries in the whole world. I don't know how they got that. They think Eritrea is doing well. I don't know where that comes from, but anyway, in Eritrea, there is an open-ended military service. Once you get in the army, there is no way you can live. If you live, and then if they catch you somewhere, they arrest you like forever, and then usually get arrested underground, if not in a shipping container. And then this shipping container is like full to the maximum extent.
What do you think Europe should do, Tsagai? What's your advice to Europe? What should they do in the face of this flood of desperate migrants?
Yeah, that's what my mom, the main point I want to say is these people, they're going to keep coming as long as the Eritrean government don't change their course. Some people are in the army since 1997. No, and then these people, they only get paid like less than $10 US dollars a month. So how do we expect them, these people, to live, support their lives? Some of them, they have wives and children.
Tsagai, I appreciate your call. Every country has its story. There's Eritrea's sort of endless military service, Tsagai says, out of Buffalo. You put it all together, and here's Europe looking at it. And this week we had the arrest outside Paris of a French Muslim with an assault rifle, apparently planning some kind of attack, shot himself instead. You can understand European ambivalence. On the other hand, the moral price of inaction is great here. There's much to be said there, but I've got to move on to one of the other big stories this week. All the talk about money, foreign money, much of it, and the Clinton Foundation. New book out, raising all kinds of issues there, Republicans all over it. Here was Rand Paul. This was on Fox News Hannity on Monday, calling new questions over those donations alarming, criticizing Bill and Hillary Clinton.
They seem to be capitalizing on their service in government, and it sure doesn't remind me of Harry Truman at all. It reminds me of people using the system to enrich themselves, and I think it looks unseemly, and I think a lot of Americans are going to agree with me.
This is a book called Clinton Cash. It's written by a former George W. Bush aide. The whole thing's not out yet, but pieces of it being leaked to different news outlets. John Podesta, chairman of Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign, defending here Clinton's against the allegations. This is with Charlie Rose, contributor Al Hunt on Monday, dismissing it. Here's Podesta.
He's cherry-picked information that's been disclosed and woven a bunch of conspiracy theories about it. The facts there's nothing new about the conspiracy theories. I guess he'll, you know, we'll get the judge when we read the book.
Juana Summers, what about this issue? It's come up before this week. The book has made it big. We've had big New York Times putting the uranium deal and Russians and Russian money coming to the Clinton Foundation on page one. What do the Clintons do about this? What appears to be the reality here?
This is really tricky. I mean, this story has been dominating cable news, and you can expect that for Republican presidential candidates to keep it going. So far, the campaign is not really coming out and saying a whole lot, but I think it is something that former Secretary Clinton will have to address, because it's part of this thing that, like, the Clintons loom large. They're this long-storied political family that has all this baggage. And I think that, frankly, is something that could turn off a lot of independent voters or Democrats who aren't so sure they like Hillary Clinton, but she might be the best they've got.
Here's Clinton herself. This was on Monday, dodging a question about allegations over special treatment for foreign donors. The Clinton Foundation, here's Clinton saying, well, at least they're talking about me.
The Republicans seem to be talking only about me. I don't know what they'd talk about if I weren't in the race, but I am in the race, and hopefully we'll get onto the issues, and I look forward to that.
Jack Beatty, what about this money issue and the Clinton campaign?
Well, New York Magazine today puts it very well, that the best case scenario on this is the Clintons have been disorganized and greedy. And greedy is really the operative word. You know, the Washington Post this week reported that Bill Clinton has received $26 million in speaking fees from entities that gave money to his foundation. So one of the defenses—
That's a lot of talking, Jack, or else very highly paid words.
Yes, yes, including a $500,000 for one speech in Moscow that seemed to be a payoff for this uranium deal. Bill Clinton— His mother once told him, this is in the biographies, Bill, yesterday has already happened. Tomorrow hasn't come. There is only today. Only live as if today. Well, that's almost the opposite of what parents usually tell children. And Bill Clinton, throughout his life, has gone right to the edge on ethical matters. And I think it's just the fact that the couple have done that as well. And you know, that's the baggage that Hillary Clinton brings. And that baggage is going to be opened up and opened up and opened up in coming months, not with Benghazi, but with this kind of thing. And I think that's why Elizabeth Warren has not given a Sherman-esque statement on not running, because it could be. I mean, if this goes on for a long time with the New York Times and the Washington Post putting it on the front page, this could seriously hurt Clinton's candidacy.
Viability issue. Scott in Reading, Connecticut. Scott, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. The broader issue, it seems to me, is campaign finance reform. The fact that foreign money can play as big a part as it is in the contributions that the Clintons are getting or the Hillary's getting, I mean, it shouldn't be permitted. But it's not just, I think a lot of people are trying to make hay out of it with respect to Hillary Clinton. It's a much broader issue than that. And the fact that foreign money can become a part of the process is an indication. It's just another indication of the broader flaws in the whole system.
Scott, point taken, and we've talked a lot about the role of money in American politics here, but this was, Yoki, come in here, this is kind of a unique situation where Hillary Clinton is Secretary of State with presidential ambitions, and here are foreign groups going not to her campaign, but to the Clinton Foundation run by a former United States president, her husband. I mean, this is kind of a unique confluence of opportunity and, I suppose, temptation here, Yoki. Do you think it looked or looks to the world like they were buying influence with the Secretary of State?
I do. And, you know, Bill Clinton has taken on this role of sort of jovial, good-natured president at large. He's a celebrity wherever he goes in the world. He's kind of beloved wherever he goes in the world. And so it's not just that you're potentially buying access to a future president, that's you're buying access to this beloved, bigger-than-life figure who, wherever he goes, draws big crowds. I think the politics here are very interesting because it, one, allows people to feed into the worst stereotype of the Clintons, that they are secretive, that they're always playing at the margins, that they're always a little bit greedy, a little maneuvering. And two, something that the Republicans, interestingly, can now use against the Democrats when Democrats normally use it against them, that you have somebody who is so wealthy that they're just completely out of touch. I mean, we think about the attacks of Mitt Romney with his elevator for his garages and his multiple houses and the size of these houses. And now you have, as Jack mentioned, you have a president and a former president, potential president and a former president earning tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. Hillary Clinton has been in the public life for so long that the last time she may have had to do anything for herself, from shopping to driving, could have been decades ago. Republicans can now say to the Democrats what Democrats have said to them effectively for decades.
Juana, help us here on one other point. Jack raises Elizabeth Warren. She and the president went back and forth this week on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this big trade deal in the offing, the TPP. The president coming out and saying that by name, that her criticisms of the deal were wrong. They were just wrong on the facts. She came back and said trade deals have not been good for the USA. What are the prospects for the TPP at the end of this week, Juana?
So House and Senate committees agreed this week to give the president fast track authority on this. And that means that we're likely to see some floor action up on Capitol Hill on this very soon. But as you note, Tom, there is a big rift among Democrats here, actually. And this deal has created some strange bedfellows, with the president actually on the side of many congressional Republicans, progressives in his own party. Not so sure they're sold on this yet.
Juana Summers, it's terrific to have you with us. I hope you'll come again. Just great to have you with us today. Thanks for your observations.
Thank you.
Juana Summers, congressional reporter for NPR News. Yoki Driesen, managing editor for news at Foreign Policy. Yoki, wonderful to have you here today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beattie, always great to have you. Thanks so much, Jack, for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, and James Ross, with help from Araz Havan, Hillary McQuilkin, and Caitlin O'Keefe. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.